Sponsorship of the KQED live audio stream comes from Stanford Continuing Studies. This winter, join Stanford historians James Sheehan and David Kennedy for The Cold War and Its Legacies, exploring the global impact of this pivotal era. Learn more at continuingstudies.stanford.edu.
Or use the free KQED app.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Good morning from Washington. Venezuela's leader, Nicolas Maduro, is facing an increased U.S. military presence off his shores and deadly strikes on boats the White House says are carrying drugs. We have a look at how he may respond. And Americans say rising prices are maxing out their budgets, just as the Fed is set to meet to consider interest rates. Plus, Jane Austen fans celebrate the 250th anniversary of the author's birth.
She's like an exquisite choreographer of conversations and exchanges.
It's Sunday, December 7th. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Louise Schiavone. Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth says the U.S. military campaign against alleged drug trafficking small boats that's killed nearly 90 people will go on. NPR's Amy Held reports that Hegseth is doubling down on a controversial September strike on survivors clinging to the wreckage of a destroyed boat.
At a defense forum this weekend, Hegseth denied a Washington Post report that he had ordered everyone on board killed and even that he had watched the second strike.
A couple hours later, I was told, hey, there had to be a reattack because there were a couple folks that could still be in the fight.
It is unclear whether Republicans who control Congress are still in the fight with Democrats to investigate. Senator Mark Warner, the top Democrat on the Senate Intelligence Committee, says not only should the public see the second strike video.
I want to see the execution order. I want to hear the communications between the admiral who made the second strike decision.
Hegseth was noncommittal about releasing the full video, saying, we'll see. Amy Held, NPR News.
3 days of high-stakes talks between U.S. and Ukrainian teams in Florida have ended without a breakthrough. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports that Russia unleashed massive drone and missile attacks on Ukraine's energy infrastructure overnight while talks were going on.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is projecting determination and a cautiously upbeat tone. And U.S. Envoy Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner said the process is moving forward even if no major concessions emerged. The key sensitive topics still to discuss include territory, the use of frozen Russian assets, and security guarantees for Ukraine. Ukrainians and the Europeans fear the U.S. will pressure Kyiv to give away too much to Russia. Speaking over the weekend, Ukraine's top commander said it would be unacceptable for Kyiv to surrender territory it has fought for and held on to. Separately, the Kremlin welcomed the Trump administration no longer calling Russia a direct threat in its revised national strategy. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Kyiv.
Apologies, but there are now 18 shopping days till Christmas. NPR's Scott Horsley tells us that consumer confidence data from the University of Michigan show economic confidence compared to this time last year is down, and inflation is casting a shadow over the upcoming spending-intensive holidays.
High prices are certainly part of the story. The Commerce Department says personal spending increased in September, but just barely enough to keep pace with those rising prices. So people feel like they're spending more, but they're not getting any more to show for it. You know, they're just kind of treading water, which is frustrating. Spending on big-ticket durable goods was actually down in September.
NPR Scott Horsley adds that concerns about employment are also part of the big picture. In India, officials are investigating a nightclub fire at a popular tourist destination in Goa State. At least 25 are known dead. This is NPR News. Japan's defense minister today lodged a protest with China after Chinese military aircraft locked radar on Japanese fighter jets. The incident occurred this weekend near Okinawa with Chinese aircraft intermittently targeting Japanese jets. No airspace was breached and no injuries were reported. Australia expressed concern over China's actions, emphasizing the need for safe interactions. Today marks the 84th anniversary of Japan's attack on Pearl Harbor. When the Empire of Japan attacked the U.S. Pacific Fleet in 1941, killing or wounding more than 3,500 Americans. NPR's Diwali Sakautau reports that only a dozen survivors remain this year.
It is no surprise that all the survivors of the December 7th attack are now centenarians. And today, not one could travel to attend a remembrance ceremony in Honolulu, according to the Associated Press. But younger generations are part of the memorial service, including Minnesota's students from the Lakeville South Band, who along with 14 mainland bands will participate in the Pearl Harbor Memorial Parade. Each year, Hawaii marks a moment of silence at the exact time the Pearl Harbor attack began at 7:55 a.m. local, and fighter jets will fly overhead in missing man formation. Diwali Sakautau, NPR News.
President Trump is hosting the Kennedy Center Award Show tonight in Washington. He'll be the first president to host the show. I'm Louise Schiavone, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping those in need is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. Regarding Pearl Harbor Remembrance Day, a local event will be this afternoon on the USS Hornet Sea Air and Space Museum in Alameda. It begins at 1 o'clock, includes a presentation on At Dawn We Slept, By Dusk We Wept with Navy veteran docent David Nagel. Again, that's this afternoon, beginning at 1 at the Hornet Sea, USS Hornet on Alameda. In our political breakdown newsletter this week, Guy Moserati looks at how Democrats are working to make health care a defining issue in next year's midterms, all the way down to the candidates they recruit. That's in the Political Breakdown newsletter. Find it at kqed.org. On Weekend Edition, Sunday morning time, 6:06. I'm Michael State. Good morning.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Good morning. President Trump is ramping up the pressure on Venezuela's leader, President Nicolas Maduro, and has been for weeks now. He's sent warships to the region. The U.S. has carried out strikes on what it says are drug boats, and he's linked Maduro to drug trafficking. That's an accusation the Venezuelan denies, and Maduro is refusing to step down. Jimmy Story co-founded Global Frontier Advisors, a geopolitical advisory, after serving as U.S. ambassador to Venezuela under both the Trump and Biden administrations, and he joins us now. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me this morning.
So President Trump has said that President Maduro's days are numbered. Do you agree?
I do. I guess fundamentally all of our days are numbered, but his in particular, after losing a,
as leader,
after losing
as
an
leader,
election.
Yeah,
of course. But after losing an election by over 70 points last year, 70% of the people went out, voted him out of office. He's not a particularly beloved figure in the country. He's completely beggared the economy. He lost an election, and he's involved with all this other kind of criminality and engagement with our strategic competitor. So I do think his days are numbered. Now, the question is when that day comes up. I think that's what we're all speculating right now.
Well, how does that happen? Because, I mean, even though, there are experts who say that he lost the election, mm-hmm. right? But he's still in power and he's refusing to step down. Do you think the U.S.
Right.
is likely to carry out military action inside Venezuela to make that happen?
I think it's increasingly likely that some type of military action takes place. I do not believe that we have the resources in the theater for an invasion, but the president has at his disposal all of the resources necessary to do limited strikes inside of the country. Again, further pressuring Maduro to step down. I think the theory of change here has been that someone close to Maduro will ask him to seek an exit. Now, that'll be very difficult, especially considering which countries are engaged inside of Venezuela. And for Cuba, this is really existential. So the Cubans are not going to want to see Maduro leave the country or step down from power.
Well, if the Venezuelan president is overthrown, does the U.S. have a plan for the day after?
Oh, that's a great question. And I've done a number of interviews over the last couple of months, and I'm like, listen, the second, third, fourth order effects are the most important here. Now, the Venezuelan people overwhelmingly voted for Edmundo Gonzalez last year, and they had the receipts. They showed the world the receipts. They actually got all the polling data from poll to poll to poll. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that he can fly back in and take over on day one. And I do think that reinstitutionalizing the country is going to be a nonlinear process. You're going to have to keep the military because you have so many illegal armed groups inside the country. And you need to reinstitutionalize the country of 25 years of these institutions being undermined. Right.
Well, is there now a need for an off-ramp for both sides?
Well, there's certainly a need for an off-ramp for Maduro. And I think that's something that under the first Trump administration we attempted, under the Biden administration we attempted via negotiations. Now, the question I have is how much is the president going to want to invest in helping a post-Maduro Venezuela? I think that's a fundamental question. Now, what is the plan?
Well, what would be the consequences for the U.S. if it once again orchestrates regime change in another country? And I mean, and dealing with the uncertainties that would come after that.
Well, let me start by saying that the Venezuelan people have already spoken. That's the first point of order, right? They've already voted him out of office. Yeah. The second is, we are suffering, the region is suffering through, and the Venezuelan people themselves are suffering through, the largest migration in the history of the hemisphere. 9 million people, 25% of the Venezuelan population has fled due to this dictatorial regime. So I think one of the questions to ask is, would it be better off without Maduro? Definitely. What is the plan for fixing the situation inside of Venezuela? It's going to be complicated, of course.
That's former U.S. Ambassador to Venezuela, Jimmy Story. Ambassador, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me today.
We've had one of the most productive Congresses in the history of the institution.
That's House Speaker Mike Johnson on Fox Business Friday.
Now, remember, in previous years, speakers had 25, 30, 40-seat majorities. I have a razor-thin majority. I have to get every single Republican on most days, and so it takes a lot of work, but we're going to get there.
But the big question is where there is, and it's a question being asked increasingly among House Republicans. Liam Donovan joins us now. He's a veteran political operative who now heads up Targeted Victory, a Republican consulting and public affairs firm. Good morning.
Good morning.
So productive is in the eye of the beholder, but what odds do you give that Republican and Republican-leaning voters will see what the GOP-led Congress has done so far as productive in November?
Well, I think the productivity has been so front-loaded, which is leading to some of the frustrations late in this year, particularly coming out of the shutdown. But that's going to be the challenge of Republicans over this next year. And I think they understand that. I think Mike Johnson is aware of that. But they need to take the accomplishments of the first half of the year, particularly around the extension of the previous Trump tax cuts and the expansion on those, especially with respect to the provisions that people really do like, and as they learn heading into next year, remember things like no tax on overtime, no tax on tips, those sorts of provisions don't go into effect until next year. So as Americans start to feel the effects of those cuts, of those policies, and Republicans go out and run on those things, I think that's the best thing they have going for them. But remember, they benefited from the affordability conversation under Joe Biden.
And now they're suffering from it now. But there is the issue of the Affordable Care Act subsidies, which seems to be a thorn for the GOP right now. Is there a deal, that would be able to appeal to Speaker Johnson, pass the House and also pass the Senate?
Look, this is a fraught issue that has really bedeviled Republicans for the last 15 years. And I think particularly if you think back to the first Trump administration, it was the first issue out of the gate that kind of that President Trump watched and I think recognized that this is something that is a little bit snake bitten for Republicans. So I think it takes some presidential leadership to be able to step up and give cover to Republicans to go do this. I think whatever the president decides, I think that will help kind of
light
the path.
Are you worried though? Because it does seem like whoever touches health care, they kind of get they face the repercussions. They face the wrath because it's a very complicated issue and it's hard to make everybody happy. So if you're the party making the changes, you may have to face the consequences.
Well, and I think that's right because this is a provision that was set to expire by the previous Democratic Congress. And so the question for Republicans is, do they own this? Do they decide to extend it when they are now in power? I think where this is heading, it certainly seems like they're more willing to begin to get into the political game of whose fault is it that it expires, who set up the system that is leading to these increases in prices. But it doesn't look like there's going to be a deal. And so the question becomes, how does this next few weeks play out in a way that allows people to go run races and try to win elections on it in the next year?
Do you think the president's successful push to redistrict House seats in Texas, Missouri, and North Carolina, and the continued push for seats in Indiana, Florida, and Kansas, do you think that's a surefire way for Republicans to keep the House?
Well, I think it depends on that last bit, those remaining states. I think whether this effort was worth it will depend on how much that advantage stretches out as we go into Florida, as we go into Indiana. As it stands right now, I think it's mostly a wash and it ends up being a lot of money and a lot of heartburn over very little structural advantage. I think at the end of the day, we look back at those election results in November, that special election in Tennessee, you're not going to be able to draw your way into a majority position. You need to improve your standing. The president needs to be a little bit more popular. You need to get the mood of the country a little bit better around this economy. They have a year to do that.
I have to ask you though, because the president is saying that affordability is a Democrat con job. How is that, you know, what are the Republicans who are running for office next year, how are they feeling about those sorts of comments?
I can tell you, I don't think that'll end up in the ads that Republicans are running. I think that's, you know, the president is, you know, frustrated by the turnabout that we just talked about. But I think Republicans will have to run their races. They'll have to tout the things that I mentioned, the things that they've done while in Congress, and the things that really will help help Americans in their pocketbook, particularly as we head into tax season.
I need to preface this one with an acknowledgement that you've worked closely with Texas Senator John Cornyn, who's up for reelection next year. There are three Republicans running in the primary, which is just over 12 weeks away. The polls are very tight between Cornyn and Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton. Does that mean that Cornyn is out of step with Texas Republicans?
No, I think this is just a continuation of what the Republican Party has gone through the last 10 or 15 years. I think the primary will play itself out. But I think the best thing that Republicans have going for them is the potential for an interesting primary on the Democratic side. As Jasmine Crockett comes in, I think every Republican in Texas around the country will welcome that addition to the race. And I think this will stay Republican in the end, no matter what. And it'll just be a distraction, I think, in the meantime.
That's Republican strategist Liam Donovan. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to NPR News.
And ahead on Weekend Edition, why do the works of Jane Austen still hold so much appeal some 250 years after her birth? More on that story and others in the next segment of the program on KQED News. I'm Michael State. Good morning. Explore festive Latinx traditions at Piñatas and Sweet Treats coming up on December 16th. The evening will feature edible treats and excerpt from a play about piñatas and hands-on activities. Tickets available at kqed.org/live and supported by San Francisco Symphony. Support for the KQED card donation program comes from local Kia dealers. Find out about how you can donate your vehicle to KQED at kqed.org/cars. And thank you.
I'm Peter Sagal. This week, the White House insulted Sabrina Carpenter and Franklin the Turtle, but despite our best efforts, not us. Join us for the apparently insufficiently provocative news quiz from NPR.
It begins later this morning at 10 on KQED.
I'm Louise Schiavone with these headlines. Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth says the U.S. military campaign against alleged drug trafficking small boats that's killed nearly 90 people will continue to protect the Western Hemisphere. 3 days of high-stakes talks between the U.S. and Ukrainian teams in Florida have ended without a breakthrough, even as Russia unleashed massive overnight drone and missile attacks on Ukraine's energy infrastructure during the talks. Department of Health and Human Services officials have altered the identification of a portrait of Biden-era transgender health official Admiral Rachel Levine. The Trump administration has removed her first name, Rachel, and inserted her pre-transgender name. I'm Louise Schiavone, NPR News, Washington.
Plenty of clouds to contend with and some dense fog in spots as well, and a chilly morning, too. It should become partly cloudy through the rest of the Bay Area day, highs the 50s to the mid-60s. Support for NPR comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy and helping clients find balance. Clients are matched with one of 30,000 therapists for online therapy from anywhere at betterhelp.com/public. And Viking, dedicated to creating travel experiences for the thinking person, with programs designed for cultural enrichment on board and on shore. Learn more at viking.com. And the listeners like you of KQED News. Michael State, good morning. Weekend edition time 6:21.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. During a Wednesday cabinet meeting, President Trump had something to say about affordability.
The word affordability is a con job by the Democrats.
When he was campaigning for re-election, though, he saw things differently. Here he is in October 2024.
One of my top priorities will be to quickly defeat inflation and make America affordable again. We will quickly defeat it. We have to bring down prices.
But what are the numbers telling us? And will whatever the Federal Reserve, which is set to meet this week, do, move the needle for the average consumer? David Tinsley is a senior economist with the Bank of America Institute, and he joins us now from London. Welcome to the program.
Hello. Thank you.
Let's start with the September Personal Consumption Expenditures Price Index, or PCE. We got those numbers on Friday. It was delayed because of the government shutdown. It shows that inflation was up by 0.3% for the month, with the annual inflation rate being 2.8%. What does that mean for consumers?
Well, I think what it means for consumers, particularly lower income consumers, is that their paychecks are not going as far. When we at Bank of America look at our own data, we find around a quarter of Americans are living paycheck to paycheck. And this kind of sticky inflation, sticky and high inflation, is an important part of that. That measure of paycheck to paycheck has been rising a little bit over the last few years, particularly for, I think, for lower income households.
The Fed is holding their final 2025 meeting this week, and we're hearing that they're likely to cut interest rates by another 0.25%. Will that make anything more affordable for the average person, including mortgages?
Well, not in the short term, I don't think. I mean, obviously, for some people, it enables them perhaps to take out a new mortgage. But obviously, a lot of people rent and a lot of people are on fixed rate mortgages. For them, in the short run, the Fed cutting won't make a huge difference, I don't think.
If what the Fed is doing doesn't have like a huge impact on people, especially in the short term, why does it get so much attention from the president, from the media?
Well, you know, it does matter in the longer term, the medium run. It matters for businesses, you know, their cost of finance, their ability to invest. It matters for the cost that the government itself can borrow at. Interest rate cuts are sort of stimulative for the economy, and that can be good for growth, ultimately for incomes and employment. You have to weigh against that, I think, the possibility that cuts prolong the period of relatively high inflation. And then that, of course, will continue then to erode people's purchasing power. And I think that's a particular issue, as I was saying, for lower income Americans.
The Bank of America Institute released a report in November that found that almost a quarter of American households are living paycheck to paycheck, meaning people are spending more than 90% of their paychecks on necessities. Are you seeing any trends within who is living paycheck to paycheck?
Well, it's growing most amongst lower income households. It's almost 30% as opposed to a quarter for lower income households. It's not really growing so much for middle income and higher income households. And then when you look across ages, millennials and Gen X are feeling under particular pressure. When you look around the country, you get a slightly different experience depending on where you are. The South and the West have the highest rates of paycheck to paycheck. I think the South, that might surprise some people, because obviously affordability in terms of housing is a bit cheaper in the South than, say, you know, the Northeast, for example. But at the same time, the average wage is lower. And it's the interplay of those two effects that ends up influencing the proportion of people living paycheck to paycheck.
Regardless of what politicians are saying, what does all these different data points tell you about how Americans are feeling about their finances and the cost of living?
Our data really does underline that you have two different experiences, really. Higher income households, where they're experiencing higher wage growth, their spending growth is higher. The average higher income household also probably owns more assets and they're experiencing equity market gains. So they're doing okay and they're feeling better. Lower income Americans are seeing slower wage growth. Obviously, they don't tend to have the financial assets and they are feeling much more squeezed. And we see that in our data, I think.
That's David Tinsley. He's a senior economist with the Bank of America Institute. Thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you.
Jane Austen created stories that cause readers and viewers to swoon.
You have bewitched me, body and soul, and I love, and love, and love you. I never wish to be parted from you from this day on.
That's, of course, Matthew McFadden from the 2005 movie version of Pride and Prejudice. This month marks the 250th anniversary of Jane Austen's birth. So NPR's Melissa Gray asked some of the writer's most ardent fans what they love about her work.
Where to find Austen enthusiasts? Not England, but Baltimore, where more than 900 members of the Jane Austen Society of North America gathered for its annual meeting this fall. To help them get into a Regency-era mindset, there were sing-alongs. Jewelry making, brooches with tiny portraits.
I love that you chose the eye. These are like lover's eyes. It was a fashion because you could wear your loved one and no one would know.
Also,
God save the king.
God save the king.
Since to be fond of dancing was a certain step toward falling in love.
Right hand star. 1, 2, 3. 1, 2, 3.
50 people in two lines face each other, some in period dress.
Knowing your right from your left with your partners and knowing which way to turn, that was the biggest challenge.
But overall, pretty easy, says Tessa Herrings. She's a high school teacher from Phoenix, here with her friend Katie Yu. While Herrings was turning her body, her mind was turning to Pride and Prejudice, the 2005 movie, where Lizzie meets Mr. Darcy at a dance. He's rich, he's broody, he's a snob, the last man in the world whom she could ever be prevailed to marry. She rejects him. Her mother freaks out. Then, baby's sister runs off with a libertine. The family will be ruined. Mama's really freaking out now, so's Papa. Wait, it's Mr. Darcy to the rescue. He's not really a snob. No, he's a hero. Second proposal accepted. The end. Whew. Tessa Herring says her English students are receptive to Jane Austen, thanks in part to that movie.
They want to read Pride and Prejudice because they want to understand all of the memes and the jokes about Mr. Darcy and so on and so forth.
That particular movie, oh, though, the big Collins. Meme is about the boiled potatoes.
Yes.
What excellent boiled potatoes.
That's the unctuous would-be suitor, Mr. Collins.
Many years since I've had such an exemplary vegetable.
As Herrings and you point out, Austen's characters are archetypes.
That's what makes them so relatable today. We all know someone who's awkward and ingratiating, like Mr. Collins, clever and independent, like Lizzie, or reticent and reserved, like Mr. Darcy. Dance instructor Tom Tumbush has read Jane Austen's books several times.
I advise young men all the time, read Jane Austen, learn how to dance.
And he knows what he's talking about, too. When he first began dating Tony, his future wife, she insisted they watch the BBC's adaptation of Pride and Prejudice. Yes, the wet Colin Firth one. But
my favorite Jane Austen character is actually Mr. Knightley from Emma.
Mr. Knightley, a hard-working gentleman and magistrate who shows Emma where she's been wrong.
Modern men struggle to find good role models. Her heroes show how men can be men, do masculine things, make the world a better place.
And he says, treat women with respect. Away from the general meeting now for views from two modern writers.
I didn't come to Jane Austen immediately. I came to Jane Austen eventually.
Author and poet Sandra Cisneros first read Austen decades ago. These days, she really appreciates the anxiety behind all those marriage plots.
There are all these issues of characters who are on the edge of poverty or living in poverty or fear of poverty in every single one of her books.
There's so much talk about debt and inheritance and who has it and who doesn't and whether someone has enough income to live independently or even comfortably.
And you know, that's why women are so concerned about who they marry and how much each eligible bachelor makes when he moves into the neighborhood.
Jane Austen was an unmarried member of the gentry class, though on the bottom rung of it, as Cisneros writes in a new introduction to the vintage classics edition of Sense and Sensibility. When Austen's father died suddenly in 1805, he didn't leave much money for his wife and daughters. His sons provided some support. A well-off one eventually provided a cottage, but the household budget was tight. With few socially acceptable ways to earn an income, Austen turned to the writing she'd long shared with family and friends. She revised an old manuscript about two sisters named Eleanor and Marianne and got it published.
The family of Dashwood had long been settled in Sussex.
They're people of money, their gentility, and then they get pushed out, moved to a little cottage that a relative gives them out of pity.
How familiar. While Sense and Sensibility didn't make Jane Austen rich, it did sell, and more novels with satiric takes on class and human folly soon followed. All six novels are still selling today.
I think you ought to be made acquainted with Mr. Eliot's real character.
She's like an exquisite choreographer of conversations and exchanges.
That's novelist Brandon Taylor. He got hooked on Austen thanks to the audiobooks narrated by Juliet Stevenson. He loves how Austen uses language. It can be delicate and poetic, funny, as well as blistering.
Oh, he is black at heart, hollow and black.
Black at heart, hollow and black. A line I think about all the time. It's my favorite read Jane Austen novel, maybe.
It's also from his favorite Austen novel, Persuasion. Anne Elliot was persuaded to reject the man she loved because he didn't have enough money. 8 years later, he's back. He's now Captain Wentworth, rich and single. But she's wilted. A spinster at 27, still. A second chance?
I think of it as being a book about what happens when you survive the worst decision you've ever made. It's like, oh, Jane Austen has provided me like a novel to teach me how to live with the after.
Austen completed Persuasion as her health was in decline. She died a year later at 41. The novel is melancholy at times, threaded through with regret and wisdom, a state well known to anyone who's hit middle age.
There's ever more thematic things at work in her novels that I discover. It's not like the book is shape-shifting. It's that I am now finally able to pick up what Jane Austen has always been putting down.
What are we looking at?
Back at the Jane Austen Society of North America's general meeting, Tam Painter of Lopez Island, Washington, flips through the Jane Austen Insult Guide for Well-Bred Women.
what strange creatures brothers are.
You are never sure of a good impression being durable.
That one is awful.
It's really bad.
Okay. The author's biting wit is only one reason Painter thinks these novels endure, 250 years after Jane Austen's birth.
There's a comfort to it. It's the comfort that you get from reading beautiful language, well-expressed ideas, but it's still going to have a happy ending. She's still going to get married at the end.
Anne will have her Wentworth, Emma her Knightley, Lizzie her Darcy, and we will have characters who are not just good company, but the best company. Melissa Gray, NPR News. You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
On KQED News, with more of the program ahead in the next segment of the program, tonight's Kennedy Center Honors in Washington, D.C., will look and sound different from past years. NPR's Elizabeth Blair will report for you just ahead. 6:35, good morning. Michael State, support for KQED comes from Landmark College, commemorating 40 years of educating people who learn differently, with programs on campus and online for both students and professionals. Learn more at landmark.edu. Frontline PBS presenting 2,000 Meters to Andriivka, a documentary about Ukrainian soldiers fighting for every inch of their land in the Russia-Ukraine war. And now streaming on PBS.org and the PBS app. Awards eligible.
She wrote a poem called Song for a Lady. And that little poem, that little scratch of a poem, was so beautiful, and it gave me a little glimpse of intimacy, of actual happiness that I could aspire to one day.
Join us for more True Stories Told Live. Next time, stories of eye-opening encounters on the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
It gets underway later this morning at 11, and then at noon, stay with us for the New Yorker Radio Hour.
Next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour, Donald Trump's least favorite senator, California's Adam Schiff.
He spends an inordinate amount of time thinking about me. I live rent-free in that guy's head, and let me tell you, it's pretty scary in there.
Senator Adam Schiff, next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour.
This week at KQED.org, you're going to meet two Bay Area teens who are mapping the movements of coyotes in Silicon Valley, plus how to understand your options for paying back student loans. That is at KQED.org. 6:37, time now for a listener perspective on KQED. The listener is Valeria Shinkarenko. Valeria sharing about how she adjusted to life in the U.S. after immigrating from Ukraine.
When I first immigrated to the United States from Ukraine, it felt like entering a new world. Everything was different. The language, the educational system, even the way people greet one another. Immigration is always talked about as a journey, but for me, it felt like walking across a bridge that was being built beneath my feet. To succeed, I had to tap into the courage to take the initiative, patience to adapt to a new society, and determination to give back to the community that was now my home. Courage was the most important element for me at the beginning. Saying goodbye to friends, school, sports, and routines was terrifying. I remember the first day in an American classroom, unable to understand half of what the teacher was explaining and afraid to ask anything. This time, I learned that courage doesn't mean being fearless. It means moving forward even when you're scared. Then came the adjustment phase. Living in a foreign country is not just about learning a language, but about understanding a culture. I realized that blending in is not losing yourself. It's about combining your origins with the new environment, sharing Ukrainian cuisine with classmates, and joining community activities helped me slowly feel at home. The most rewarding part has been learning how to give back. Immigrants bring energy, creativity, and perspectives that improve society. Now I understand that immigration is not just relocation, but transformation. I arrived as a shy teenager and emerged stronger, more resilient, and determined to contribute to my community. Sharing these stories reminds others that immigrants are not outsiders, but neighbors working toward the same future. With The Perspective, I'm Valeria Shinkarenko.
Valeria Shinkarenko is a college student studying business administration. She lives in Pleasanton, and she says she enjoys snowboarding and traveling across the U.S. Support for Perspectives comes from Comcast, dedicated to serving California communities by offering digital equity initiatives and providing financial donations to help families and seniors get online and participate in the digital economy. More at california.comcast.com. Starting out the day with plenty of clouds and some patchy dense fog as well. Becoming partly cloudy through the day, highs today the 50s to the mid-60s for the Bay Area. At 6:40, more of Morning Edition, a weekend edition, pardon me, with Aisha Roscoe is on the way.
I'm Louise Schiavone with these headlines. After 2 years of the Israel-Hamas war in Gaza, Christmas celebrations are returning to Bethlehem in the occupied West Bank. Palestinians are hoping the festivities marking the traditionally acknowledged birthplace of Jesus will be another building block for peace. A senior official in Benin's government says a coup declared by a group of soldiers has been quashed. Authorities there say 14 people have been arrested in the coup attempt. Hong Kong today pressed ahead with highly managed legislative elections, despite the fact that authorities are still searching for human remains after a massive blaze killed at least 159 people in one of the region's deadliest fires in a century. I'm Louise Schiavone, NPR News.
Good morning. Support for NPR comes from Subaru. The Subaru Share the Love event runs through January 2nd. And by year's end, Subaru and its retailers will have donated more than $350 million to charity. Subaru, more than a car company. And Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Since 1946, AU has supported the First Amendment right of freedom of religion. More at AU.org. And the listeners like you of KQED News, 88.5 in the Bay Area, 89.3 in Sacramento. Always online, too, at KQED.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. D-Day, 1944. Charles Norman Shea is a 19-year-old member of the Penobscot Nation, serving as an army medic as Allied forces stormed Omaha Beach. Shea left that day a hero. He died Wednesday at age 101. As Maine Public Radio's Caitlin Badayan reports, Charles Norman Shea was one of the first indigenous soldiers from that era to share his experiences.
Charles Norman Shea was awarded the Silver Star for going back into the water on D-Day to pull injured soldiers to shore, saving them from drowning. Shea had been drafted into the Army after the United States joined World War II. He was trained as a medic and transferred to the 16th Infantry Regiment, one of the three combat regiments of the 1st Infantry Division that spearheaded the Normandy invasion, later known as D-Day. In an interview with Maine Public in 2007, Shea recalled returning to the water.
I don't know how I ever did it. And I pulled several men up out of the water and to the safety of the, out of the water to the beach. I did what I could for them. I don't know where my strength came from, but I was able to save several lives.
Shea would later become one of the first indigenous soldiers to talk about his experiences in battle, said Harold Prince in an interview with Maine Public last year. Prince is the co-author of From Indian Island to Omaha Beach, the D-Day Story of Charles Shea.
Most people, when they go to American Indian reservations, they want to know about moccasins, tribal dances, shamans, you name it. But they don't really think about the fact that many of these Native Americans have traveled all across the world and fought across the world.
Shea re-enlisted after World War II and was later deployed in Korea before he retired in 1954 as a master sergeant. He was awarded France's highest award, the Legion of Honor, in 2007 and moved to the Normandy region of France in 2018, where he lived until his death on Wednesday. In an interview with Maine Public last year, Penobscot Nation Chief Kirk Francis said Shea is held in high esteem by his community.
I'm just proud of the ambassador that he is and the example he sets for people and how people look at Indian people in general. That's a guy that should be emulated.
A post on Shea's Instagram page says he died peacefully, surrounded by family. He was 101. For NPR News, I'm Caitlin Badayan in Bangor, Maine.
Tonight, picking up Kennedy Center honors, Sylvester Stallone, George Strait, the rock band Kiss, Gloria Gaynor, and English actor and singer Michael Crawford. The gala in Washington, D.C. celebrates achievements in the performing arts every year. Stars saluting other stars often produces big, memorable moments, like when Carole King won in 2015. One of Carole King's biggest hits, performed by Aretha Franklin. This year's Kennedy Center Honors will be different from years past. And here to tell us more about that is NPR culture correspondent Elizabeth Blair. Thank you for being here, Elizabeth.
Thanks for having me, Aisha.
So you've covered the Kennedy Center Honors for many years now. How is this award different from other entertainment awards?
A Kennedy Center honor is traditionally for artists who've made a major contribution to the performing arts. It's considered to be a prestigious lifetime achievement award that in theory has cultural gravitas. Past winners include people like Quincy Jones, Gladys Knight, George Clooney, LL Cool J, and Alvin Ailey. The format is that for each of the five honorees, other celebrities and artists show up to perform these tributes to them, either in speeches or songs. The honorees typically sit in the presidential box with the president and the first lady while these lavish tributes unfold on stage.
So it's a little like Hollywood on the Potomac. And I know the Kennedy Center has brought in some very big names to celebrate the honorees, like when Beyonce sang for Tina Turner or Alison Krauss for Dolly Parton. What are some of your favorite moments from past honors?
I have many favorite moments. When Yo-Yo Ma won in 2011, he was serenaded by James Taylor, John Williams, and a children's choir.
Here comes the sun. Here comes the sun. I see it's all right.
Another favorite moment is when Meryl Streep won. Emily Blunt was a total fangirl.
She actually has two jobs. The first is her own performance, which is always just breathtaking. And secondly is the task of stabilizing the other actor who is having a nervous breakdown because they're in a scene with Meryl Streep.
So in his second term, President Trump has gotten very involved with cultural institutions, and that includes ousting the Kennedy Center's previous leadership and becoming chair of its board. How has his takeover affected the Kennedy Center honors?
In a few different ways. In the past, the selection process took several months and involved a lot of different stakeholders. This year, it's really the President Trump show. He said he was 98% responsible for selecting the honorees. Something else that's different is that he will be hosting the event. Usually that job is left to people who are not the President of the United States. Previous hosts include Queen Latifah and Stephen Colbert.
President Trump said he was asked to host and then mused that he might give himself the honor. The honor is this rainbow-colored medallion.
That's what it has been in the past. It's a big change this year. The medallions used to be these bright rainbow-colored satin necklaces with gold nameplates. They were handmade by the same family since the very first honors in 1978. This year, there's a brand new medallion made by Tiffany & Company. It has a dark blue ribbon, and the rainbow has moved onto the medal itself. I mention this because in years past, the rainbow necklaces really stood out when you saw photos or watched the broadcast. You could easily identify which celebrities had won the awards because they all showed up proudly wearing these medallions.
Do we know who will be coming to Washington to pay tribute to this year's honorees?
We don't know, and that is not different from previous years. The Kennedy Center has always tried to keep the performers a secret. The look of surprise on the honorees' faces when they see who has turned out to pay them their respects has made for some really fun, poignant TV moments. But we do know a few performers who will not be there. Bonnie Raitt and Herbie Hancock, who have both been honorees and performers in the past, confirmed to NPR that this year their schedules won't allow them to come.
That's NPR culture correspondent Elizabeth Blair. Thank you so much, Elizabeth.
Thanks for having me.
The musician Sev DeLiza had two albums under her belt and yet wasn't feeling accomplished.
Becoming a mother, being an artist that, you know, I wasn't making a lot of money. I was really struggling, to be honest. And I couldn't even support my family.
Spending time in the studio making new music helped Sev DeLiza, born Sevda Elizadeh, regain her footing. And now she has a new album featuring the single Alibi.
I specifically aimed to make that song an anthem, and I started the demo while I had my six-month-old baby on my lap. What I wanted to do is I wanted to celebrate feminine power, but I also wanted to save myself from the situation I was in.
Sev DeLiza's new album is called Heroína.
Basically, heroína, the way you spell it, it's the Spanish version of the word heroin. And I did like the wordplay that it's also derived from form of drugs, because I think that the mechanics of being an artist, the noradrenaline that rushes through your body when you're making music, the calm down after a show and when you're playing in front of 30,000 people, the highs and lows, the experiences you have are very similar to if you're addicted to something.
You also share some of your immigration story on this album. Can you talk to me about your early life experience, like moving to Europe from Iran?
Yeah. So I was born during the Iran-Iraq war. My earliest memories are really marked by instability and a kind of like an ambient fear. But when you grow up inside a crisis, you don't label it as a crisis. You just experience it as reality. And leaving Iran at 4 years old, I absorbed that disorientation of, you know, suddenly feeling foreign everywhere. It also really shaped my perception. And I do think that the qualities that I realized as an adult were actually trauma-born traits are the ones that really help me in life. I'm like super observant. I'm very intuitive. I'm always like watching my own back. And what's really interesting to me is that my identity has become so fluid because I am a refugee and I grew up in Rotterdam and I was exposed to so many cultures in so many countries.
You talked about being vigilant and kind of strength. You have this song, I'm Strong Because You Are. How does that capture some of maybe those feelings?
Well, Strong Because You Are was a song that I wrote for my mother. You know, when we came to the Netherlands, she was alone because my dad was still in prison. She really had to build up her life from scratch with a young child.
I've been waiting my whole life for this moment, I swear, mama.
as I became a mother, of course, I had way more privileges that she and my dad fought for, but I still had to go through similar experiences, traveling the world to create financial and career stability whilst having a young baby. It was quite difficult.
And when you say your father was in prison, was he in prison because of the Iran-Iraq war?
No, he was in prison because he was basically a political prisoner.
Once you got to Europe with your family, to Rotterdam, you got involved in sports and you became a basketball player. Did you find any connections between, like, you know, the basketball court and pop music?
I would say being a professional athlete in an environment that is not really inviting definitely set me up for being able to go beyond the grain and being able to deal with disappointment. Playing on the highest level is not easy. You know, some coaches like you, some coaches dislike you, some team members you don't get along with. You have injuries. It's really strange, but if you've done that on a high level, it's difficult afterwards to find your boundaries because you know you can mentally go over them.
Did you start making music after you were done with basketball?
No, I finished my university. I did my master's and my first job was at MTV, actually. That was my first introduction to the world of artists. And that's when I realized that I wanted to make music.
So you have strong religious imagery in your music. Talk to me about this song, Messiah.
For me, religion is a very, very contradictive topic. I grew up in a country that oppresses women by deliberately using religion. So Messiah was born from a fantasy of centering the woman in religion, not shaming our sexuality.
It's putting all of that together, sexuality, womanhood, and putting women at the center. You have been through so much, and on this record, I know you've been talking about those struggles, but you also talk about, like, womanhood and what it means to be a woman today.
Yeah, I would say that, you know, my entire way of making music is a reflection of that, and also how I carry myself, how I make my decisions on everything. Feminine intuition, that kind of like womb energy, I carry that. Heroina for me reflects the kind of power that was born from survival. It's not a glorified cinematic version, but it's the quiet, persistent force you develop when life has stripped you down to your core.
Sev DeLisa, her new album is called Heroina. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe.
More of the program ahead, including a political look ahead with Aisha Roscoe and NPR's Mara Liasson. We'll have updates from NPR News ahead. Dana Cronin with a KQED news update coming up as well. Good morning. Support for NPR comes from Bayer. Bayer is dedicated to delivering breakthroughs that save lives and feed the world using the scientific process. Learn more at sciencedelivers.com. And Progressive Insurance. Progressive is looking for individuals in a variety of career fields who want to help build a culture of inclusiveness. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers.
I'm Farida Javala Romero, and I'm a labor correspondent at KQED. A lot of my stories are about communities of color, many of them immigrants. And with these stories, we can build a bridge to have that connection, you know, connecting different communities that may not be talking to each other directly, because we all make the Bay Area what it is. Help KQED keep public media free and accessible. Donate today at kqed.org/donate.
Support for KQED comes from Netflix, presenting Apocalypse in the Tropics. The documentary by Petra Costa investigates the fast rise of the evangelical movement in Brazil and the consequences for politics and democracy. Now on Netflix, awards eligible.
Next time on City Arts and Lectures, Padma Lakshmi, television host and cookbook author. She'll talk with comedian W. Kamau Bell about her newest book, Padma's All-American, Tales, Travels, and Recipes from Taste the Nation and Beyond. That's next time on City Arts and Lectures, here on KQED.
This afternoon, beginning at 1. Hey, this week on Close All Tabs, whatever happened to Purple Moon Games? Close All Tabs talks to the company's founder about its impact on girls in tech and how it all came to an abrupt end. Find that story.